This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Today on the program, we welcome James Houston back to the program. Houston lived for many years in the Arctic, then moved to Manhattan to become a designer for Steuben Glass. He's responsible for bringing the art of the Inuit to our southern world and setting up a market for it. James Houston now divides his time between a home in Connecticut and a summer place in the Queen Charlotte Islands. He was recently involved in setting up a major exhibition of the best of Inuit art from 1950 to 1970 for the Museum of Civilization in Ottawa. He is the author of many books, including The White Dawn, which was made into a movie. His latest novel is The Ice Master. This afternoon, we'll talk with him about his new volume of memoirs, Zigzag, A Life on the Move. The book picks up where Confessions of an Igloo Dweller left us. Zigzag is published by McClelland and Stewart. Questions for our guest, James Houston, are welcome in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else in Illinois or Indiana, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. James Houston, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Celeste.
How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Good to hear you again.
Good to hear you as well. Before we talk about Zigzag, could we revisit Confessions of an Igloo Dweller for a moment?
Surely.
Would you tell us how you first got to the Arctic?
Well, I went to the Arctic by accident, in a way. I'd been away in the war for 5 years between 1940 and 45 in a Highland regiment. And I didn't know what to do with myself after I got back to Canada. I studied art in Paris for a year, and then I thought, well, I don't want to stay around in southern Canada. I'd like to go up north and do some drawings and paintings. I didn't dream that I would get into the Arctic, but I did go into Swampy Cree country. Down at the bottom of James Bay. So... then I had the luck to have a flight into the Arctic, and a medical emergency. We used to receive mail once a year, once I got in there, so that's to remember what a remote place it was. And so I was surrounded by short, strong, laughing brown people who all dressed in seal skins and other things, and they crowded around me and watched me make drawings, and then they took this sketchbook away from me and started making drawings of me and so on. I thought, where else would I find people like this? Not in Chicago or Toronto or New York or Paris. And so that started a long life with me, an adventure with them that lasted for 12 years.
Yeah. And getting there, it turned out, was a lot easier than leaving.
Very much so. It was a heart-rending experience to leave.
Yeah. Late spring of 1962, though, you did say goodbye. Why?
Well, I thought Celeste Quinn will call me up and she'll say, Mr. Houston, I hear you've lived in the Arctic for 40 years. I'll say, yes, that's true, if I'd stayed on and on and on. So somebody offered me the opportunity, the president of both the Metropolitan Museum of Art and Steuben Glass offered me the opportunity to go south and live in Manhattan and design glass for Steuben. So, based on everything he'd seen that was going on in the Arctic about Inuit art. Mm-hmm. So, that took me down there. And I stayed in Manhattan for 9 years, and I enjoyed it very much indeed, although it was a total and utter contrast to everything that I had known.
Yeah. Now, once you left Cape Dorset, did the Inuit Art Cooperative continue?
It certainly did, and flourished, and has become much larger than it was when I departed. It now has an Inuit manager who's ahead of it, and they have developed a store, which is like a small sort of supermarket that does everything for them. They still live on West Baffin Island in one of the most remote places in the world. And their population is small, fewer than 1,000. It was about 460 when I met them, so you can see that during the that almost 50-year period, it increased considerably.
Yeah. Do they still not sign their work?
No, they do. They do sign it more now in syllabics. That's their language or their written form of Inuktitut, and so they sign it now. They didn't in the beginning at all. But it was thought like some of the best Japanese pottery that you were supposed to recognize who had done it. And indeed, I could easily recognize who had done it.
Yeah. Maybe you would tell us here the story of the Japanese folk potter you met who talked with you about not signing his work.
Yes. He was a very famous folk potter in Japan who was able to... he followed the great tradition of folk pottery and just created his own things, and people all recognized them, and it wasn't the style, and it wasn't permitted in that particular style to sign work. And once I went into a large store called Takoshimayo, where they frequently have their best exhibitions in Japan of current work up on the top floor. And Soji Hamada said, well, we'll go up there. And I had an interpreter. He does not speak English. And when we came into the ground floor, there was a huge array of pottery that all looked exactly like his. I thought exactly. He went around picking up pieces, turning them in his hands, looking at them, these imitations of his work.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, I said, oh, how terrible, how awful. He said, no, it's not awful at all. He said, later when I die, he said, people will look at the very best things and say, oh, Hamada made this. And they'll look at the very worst things of mine and say, well, Hamada couldn't have made this.
Mm.
I thought that was a great approach to the subject.
It's a wonderful approach. Well, tell us how you met Arthur Houghton Jr., the head of Steuben Glass.
Well, he decided to come into the country, come into the Arctic. He met Pearson, who was the head of United Nations at the time, and at UN, he was the director. And he asked him how he should go in and look at Eskimo art, they called it at the time, very much. And Pearson said, well, you should go and see this guy, Houston. He's never... He said, we asked him when he was coming out, and he said, never. And so go and see him, and that's the closest you'll ever come to it. So they sent me in boot sizes. They wanted sealskin boots made and parkas and pants and all the equipment that you could have. So I started to, after that, I started to take it seriously that he, with a party of seven, planned to come into the Arctic and stay for 3 weeks or two weeks or 3 weeks. They weren't sure about that. So he came in a very elaborate way. There was no place to keep them at King Knight or Cape Dorset. So I went out and found a lovely piece of tundra on a bay called Telikjuak. And I built a camp there, a tent camp, and even inside, big Arctic poppies, yellow poppies, were growing on the floors of inside the tents because we just put them down. And they were enchanted by it and loved it. Mm. And so he asked me at that time if I would consider coming south and working for Steuben. And I said, no, I won't. I've got 3 years of part. The Inuit at the co-op, that after 3 years, I was definitely going anyway. I might just move to a different place in the Arctic, but I felt I should. So he said, well, why don't you try Manhattan? And I did.
Talk about an outpost.
Yeah, I should say.
That was quite a switch. Now, you are, and you were then, an artist. But had you any experience working with glass?
No, I never touched a piece of glass except to take a sip out of a glass.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't know anything about it. And they said, well, we have a kind of back furnace on the blowing room floor. Many people, many of your listeners will probably have seen that down at the Museum of Glass in Corning. And he said, you should work at the back furnace where no one will see you making all the mistakes you'll make. And we'll put you with a very good glassmaker. And so work there for a month or a couple of months and see if you can't get the hang of it. So I did that. And after a couple of months of work with really good gaffers and so on, I did sort of have the hang of it. And so I was able to go forward. I have this boastful thing to say that I've made more than 110 separate designs, and that's more than anybody's ever done in the history of the company.
Wow. How is designing a piece of glass different from designing something in, say, metal or clay?
Well, it's very different. I have a piece of glass right in front of me now because I still make glass and do things like that, design it. And the terrible thing part about it is you can see right through it to the back. Learn to use that properly so that it works in your favor, not against you. Well, you can have some wonderful designs. Glass will sometimes do marvelous things for you that you wouldn't dream of. You try to make something that's kind of simple, and when you're finished and it's cold and you take it out of the kiln and look at it, you're astonished that it's vastly better than you expected. Or you quickly smash it up in a barrel and get rid of it and try again.
Yeah. I would like to mention here that you also have another book out that's very new, Fire Into Ice, Adventures in Glassmaking.
Yes.
And the cover features your design, Arctic Fisherman.
Uh-huh.
Boy, is that gorgeous.
Aren't you nice to say that? Boy, was it fun to make that.
Yeah, a design that, now this design incorporates gold.
Yes.
The glass, of course, is ice.
It was silver. Some of them do incorporate gold.
Oh, okay.
But when gold rose from $35 an ounce, I mean, I go back almost 50 years in the business, but when it rose from $35 an ounce to $916 or something, we sort of decided not to. We thought of buying back any we had sold. It had risen so precipitously. And so we started to use sterling silver instead of gold. And that design is sterling silver, which goes very well with the glass.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Not at all.
I have only seen this on the internet. The cover of the book.
I see.
I looked for it in our local bookstores, and it's not here at the moment.
Well, that's a shame. It should be.
Yeah.
If you ask any local bookstore to get any book for you, they usually put it on their computers and have it in a few minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, a few days.
Yeah. Well, I've ordered a couple for Christmas presents.
Good.
Okay. Well, let's talk about a little bit more about this wonderful sculpture. From what I can see on the internet, engraved in the lower right hand, two fish.
Yes, Arctic char.
Yeah, and atop the ice, the fisherman in silver.
Right.
With his spear plunging into the ice.
Right. That's called a kakivok. It's a special kind of spear that catches fish. It's not like the trident you usually see, but it's a whole different style of spear that works like a pair of pincers and grabs the fish from the sides and brings it up, not down through it.
would you talk with us about the process of coming up with this idea and then how you moved from the idea to the finished piece?
Well, yes. First of all, I had loved fishing, and I had done lots of it through the ice. We'd make a hold, and the ice would be several feet thick. And we'd make a hole and then lie down or kneel down, as that fisherman is doing, and put your face very close to the hole. And you can look down, and it's even rather magnified. And you can see sometimes, not always, schools of Arctic char coming past the hole. And the trick is to dart down with the spear at just the right moment. Sounds easy, and you always imagine the first time you ever do it that, of course, you'll get something, but of course you don't. And so it's quite a trick. And then as you get more and more fish, and you hope you will, because there's always lots of widows and people in the little village of Kingknight that you would like to supply. So you must be very careful to place the fish around you in a perfect ring with their heads all in towards the hole, or you won't catch any more, they think.
Oh, interesting. So this was right out of your experience in the Arctic.
Exactly.
The idea for this piece.
And I started in Steuben. I know that I was the first person to combine metal with glass in Steuben. Probably some other people. In fact, they had done it in the 15th century and so on, put golden heads on decanters and so on to be able to open and close them. But I was the first to do it in modern times. And so that was thought to be a sort of daring process, and everybody didn't love it within the company, but finally they came around, and now they do like it very much.
Yeah. Were there pressures on you? You mentioned that you produced more designs for Steuben than any other designer. Were the pressures on you and other designers to produce a certain number of sculptures in a given period of time?
No, not in any way. Some people made one sculpture in a year and a half or 2 years.
Wow.
Other people, sometimes at the top of my form, I made 12 a year. So there was no pressure at all. In fact, how's this for a wonderful company that they said to me, Arthur Houghton said to me at that time, he said, I don't want you coming in here every day of the week. Why don't you? I'd rather think that you were up at the Metropolitan looking at wonderful things from the past and trying to get ideas. He said, I'd like you to fly out to San Francisco, go to the Field Museum in Chicago, and go to all the major museums here and in Europe and see what they're, you know, look at the past. Draw your ideas from wonderful things from the past. So how's that for... Most companies don't take a liberal view like that.
Great boss.
Yeah, I should say so.
You write he was very fond of architecture, and he had working for him a designer by the name of Jack Gates.
Yes, indeed.
And he was a Harvard-trained architect.
Indeed.
How did architecture influence the work of Steuben Glass?
Well, too much, in my view.
Really?
I have to say that. I mean, I was very fond of Jack Gates. He was one of my best friends, as was Arthur. They both were. And they were both mad for architecture. And they were both Harvard men and very fond of all that. And I didn't care anything about architecture. I mean, I thought it was nice if you were going to make a big building or something, you would do it. But for a small, smallish piece of glass, I couldn't quite get it. But their main thing, they were very preoccupied with having a very exact drawings after you had finished making the glass or you were starting, before you started. They wanted very exact architectural type drawings and plans. Well, I didn't do that. And there's a great joke down at the factory at Corning Glass. Somebody came around the floor head and said, where are Houston's designs for this piece? Where are the drawings? They want them in New York. The people working on the floor in front of the red-hot furnace, which we called a glory hole, they said, well, if you get a jackhammer and come over here, you could chisel this one right out of the floor, because he drew it in chalk on the floor in front of the glory hole. So that was the way I worked.
Yeah. So you had to do a lot of communicating then with your gaffers.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
You bet. Wonderful people. And, you know, one of the usual things that would happen, we would not, other designers as well, you would take a piece of hot glass, I mean roaring hot, to 2,500 degrees, and put it anywhere near the drawing board, one of the first things that would happen was the drawing would catch on fire, and then your eyebrows would catch on fire, or not catch fire, but singe off. You could smell the awful smell of hair burning as you lost your eyebrows, and so on. So drawings were not all they were cracked up to be. I mean, I think it's the ideas within them. The piece. I mean, after you've done it, it's okay to follow up with some drawings, but it's a pity to have the designer utterly preoccupied with the drawings instead of trying to think of a new piece.
Yeah. Now, from time to time, you would put those heavy gloves on and you would get into the furnace.
Yes.
What does that, outside of the heat, what else is going on?
Well, I feel that a piece of glass will never in its whole history look as well as it does on the end of a blowing iron or a pontle iron, we call it, when there's no hole in the middle. I rarely blew glass. I work with solid glass. I still do. And so when you have shaped that to the form you wanted, and if it's an angel, you put wings on it, or you've done all kinds of things to it, it'll glow as white turning down to yellow, bright yellow, and then down to red and so on. And it's absolutely full of life and sparkle. And you'll never see it. Once it gets cold, it may look well, but it'll never look that well again.
Yeah.
And so that's a thrilling moment. Then we call it crack-off, where you take the iron and you give it a smart blow with something like a heavy file. And somebody has to catch it with a pair of asbestos gloves. And very thick ones, an inch thick or so, and then take and put it in the kiln. And that will slowly rotate it, depending on 12 or 24 hours, depending on how thick the glass is, and let it cool down before it comes out. If it came out the way it was, it would just blow into pieces.
Hmm. Now, your friends from the north, did anyone come and visit you there at Corning at the at the Glory Hole?
Yes. One person in particular, in fact, two did, at different times, and they were astonished with all that, but they could hardly wait to get their hands on a blowing pipe and have a go at it. They were thrilled by it.
Wow.
And they would have been darn good at it. I can promise you that. It's in their nature to be good at things like that.
Yeah. Now, the Inuit that you hunted with, you worked with, you lived with, they never complained about the cold.
Not at all.
Did they complain about that furnace?
Yes, they did. they couldn't. They wanted to strip to the waist, and they couldn't believe that you could ever stand in front of it. Oh, they minded heat a lot, but they were great about cold. So, I mean, God or somebody has certainly made people and specialized kind of people for whatever they do.
Yeah. Well, tell us, if you would, what was involved when you wanted to take a bath up there on Baffin Island.
Well, most of the time, and the life I lived, it was just plain impossible. You couldn't do it. You might take a little rag and dampen it after you'd made tea, save a little bit and pour it into a little rag and do something or other. But mostly it wasn't. And finally, the government built me a house. I wasn't eager to have that because the house sort of ties you down. It's lovely to be living in an area of 65,000 square miles where you don't feel you have any fixed place of abode, that you're free to move all over it. That's why Inuit had such good relationships with each other. If they ever had the slightest feeling of displeasure with each other, they would just pick up and move. We're bound by possessions. I'm bound by possessions in this house I'm sitting in. It's mine. I paid for it. I want to keep it. But in those wonderful old days, the whole of the country was yours. You can move anywhere. Just hitch up your dog team and go. And that's a marvelous feeling to be beyond possessions.
Yeah.
And so when they built a little house, they put in a bathtub, but of course they were afraid to, there was no water delivery system because we couldn't possibly, it would freeze up right away. I mean, we had weather at 50 below zero and colder than that, with big high winds which will guarantee to freeze everything. So you would have to heat up water on a Primus stove, take it up, pour it into the bathtub, get in, wash up a bit, get out, then bail the whole tub out and carry it outside and throw it away. What was the carrying it outside afterwards to make you wonder if it had been worth it to take the bath?
That wash.
You forget about bathing. Why people need to bathe in Chicago and New York and everywhere is that it's wildly hot in summer. People perspire, and then it's a sort of smelly business. If you live where I live, there's no danger of perspiring at all, so it really isn't a problem.
Yeah. Well, after thinking about that ordeal of taking a bath, I think that the washcloth with a little water left over from the teapot is the way to go.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Even that seemed pretty extreme after you lived there for a while.
You know, the title of your new book is Zigzag, and,
yeah.
and talk about zigzag. You took a great big zigzag in plumbing. Maybe you would describe the commode that you found in the guest quarters of Arthur Houghton's home when you upon arriving in Manhattan.
Well, he had a great house down on at Sutton Place on the river with a huge, almost block-sized garden where Marion Davies, who had been a great friend of Hearst, had an apartment, and Onassis, of the Onassis fame, had a... So the three of them shared this block-long, huge garden looking out on the river. And in Arthur's house, which was a four-story house, an old, very old-fashioned house, by the way, that had belonged to, famous, never mind.
Oh, was it Onassis?
Anyway,
Onassis?
No. Oh. From the past.
Oh, from the past.
A huge money man from the past.
Oh, okay.
Host in New York.
Like a Carnegie or a Mellon or somebody like that.
Yeah, but neither of those.
Right.
The other one. You're having a little trouble, too. So
I am.
Yeah. Okay, I'll think of it in a moment. Anyway, it was an ancient house, but it had a elevator put in it so you could easily rise to the floors and so on. And the Houghtons kindly put me in a bedroom, and it had a large bathroom about the size of our bedroom, and I looked around for the toilet, but I couldn't find one. I thought, surely this is a bedroom or a bathroom. But anyway, there was a grand-looking, on a dais, raised dais, was a grand-looking chair, a kind of something you would expect Napoleon to have with embroidered and, absolute gold-edged and carved and elegant. And so you went over and raised, finally you got the message, and raised the little seat of the chair, and sure enough, there it was hiding. So imagine an introduction to life where I had not known a toilet for 12 years into a toilet like that.
Yeah, boy, what a time of adjustment.
What a terrific time is the... I mean, it was exciting all the time. I had seen so few people in a way, and yet now I would walk down 3rd Avenue or 5th, and just coming towards me would be thousands of people, with short people, tall people, dark people, every kind of person coming towards me, laughing, talking, smiling, growling, whatever they did. I was a person that made drawings of life, drawing of people and so on. It was just a wonderful treat to see it all happen.
For a time, you taught art in a high school in Harlem.
Yes, I did.
How did that come about?
Well, there was a large race riot up in Harlem in the early 60s, and they formed something called Harlem Youth in Action. And I liked the sound of that. I thought, I used to work with Inuit people, and here I am in New York having a good time and not contributing very much, so why don't I try to teach art in a situation like that? So I made inquiries from various people. Houghton had ideas about that. So I was in contact with a minister, a black minister in Harlem, who suggested that I go up there and start to do that, which I did, and I found young people full of talent, teenagers that were eager to do art projects and to go forward with their lives in that direction, and it was pretty thrilling, but it came to a sudden end with the another person that I worked with, a black person, was really quite seriously hurt, and so that changed the whole dynamic of the thing, and it never worked very well after that, but still, it had been a great experience, I hope, for them and certainly for me.
Yeah. It reminds one of, you know, how wonderful the Inuit way of life is, or
right.
or can be, that right. attitude of there must be fish for everyone.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
They feel they have the mobility to move. They've always thought of feeding each other. They don't think of themselves as being one family. That's the highest form of government, by the way, among the Inuit in the 50s, was the head of the family, the father. There was no government beyond that person. Until I became government up there, and then I did not admit it to them. I tried to keep it from them because I didn't think they should have anybody above them. But however, you were able to be helpful in some ways. And so they would try to give, they would always give a bit more than they took for themselves. They were very careful to do that. And they would go to any length to help each other. And of course, they allowed that to extend to us, to our family, because they just built us into the whole equation in a moment.
Yeah. Well, you would have been in bad shape if they hadn't taken you in.
Oh, we couldn't have lived. I don't think I would have lived for 3 days.
Yeah.
We were in such hard circumstances, and they were so utterly knowledgeable about the cold and the life in that way and so on. I saw a picture of an author, an Arctic person who had been traveling across the Arctic, or part of the Arctic, and he had a hand frozen off, was gone, showed a picture of it. I showed that to some of my Inuit friends fairly recently, the missing hand. And they said, well, he had to be traveling alone. We would not have let that happen to him. I mean, it's unthinkable to us. None of them had ever lost a hand.
Yeah. We've got a caller waiting to talk with us.
Okay.
Before I do that, though, I just want to quickly ask you about, on this same kind of idea, the Inuit attitudes toward money and banking, and it's important to have
right.
the money
right.
at home so it can help others.
Right. We think of it as virtuous. If you found some poor people who you considered people who didn't have money, and they all of a sudden started to save it and put it in a bank, and they started to build a bank account, we would think that's very virtuous of them. I mean, my goodness, this is the beginning of a whole new experience and so on, and it's marvelous. Well, I encouraged several of them who had made quite a substantial amount of money from their carvings, to put the money in the bank over at a place called Iqaluit, which was about 400 miles away. And they put it in there at my suggestion, but they said later they felt very uneasy and it was very wrong. They said it was like keeping the meat for themselves and not sharing it with other people, and that they wished to take the money out and give it away to the other people so that they could have it. And believe me, that's exactly what they did.
James Houston is our guest this afternoon. His latest book, Zigzag, A Life on the Move. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our first caller this afternoon is on line one in Urbana. Hello.
Hi. I got in on the conversation when you were talking about your tub bathing experience. And I just was curious to know where you were in the Arctic.
I was on West Baffin Island. If you know Baffin Island, and you probably do, I hope you do.
Yeah, I was in Arviat, Eskimo Point.
Right, I know it well.
Yeah.
That's more or less straight across Hudson's Bay, North Hudson's Bay. We're to the east of you.
Right. What town, what village were you in?
Iqaluit, King Knight or Cape Dorset.
Mm.
It has both, they're increasingly referring to it as King Knight.
Right. I was a nurse in Arviat, and
oh,
I believe I knew of one gal who took the same outpost nursing program that I did, who was at Cape Dorset.
Good.
What year were you there? Years.
I was there, I went in 1951, long, long time ago, perhaps before you were born, and I came out in 1962.
Wow.
But I've been back this year. I've been into the Arctic 26 times since coming out, so I do bounce back and forth a lot.
I appreciate your comments about the Inuit sharing. When I was in the North, I tried to be with the people as much as I could.
Good.
Learned a fair amount of the Inuktitut language.
Atau.
And used to go into the homes, and, you know, they'd have that caribou meat on a piece of cardboard on the floor, and anybody was welcome to carve off a hunk and help themselves. And
sure.
More often than not, I would sit down and have a piece of caribou meat, and as long as I sliced it very thin, I could enjoy it, but if it got too thick, it was just too much of a reminder that it was raw meat. And I've never had to have an ultrasound in my liver.
You couldn't have been there too long. You should have. How long did it take you to get over that?
Pardon?
How long did it take you to get over minding the meat being raw?
I was only there for about 3 years.
I see.
And I always ate it very thin. I was never able
well,
to
get it. That's not bad. I mean, as long as you ate it.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter much how... I tried to slice mine thin, too.
Yeah, and even when you mentioned the thought that you tried not to place yourself above the people,
yeah.
I had a grandmother who was dying in the village and went into the home, and the old people were saying, Nayangwaknak.
Yeah.
And I, Nayangwa, meaning nurse, I was saying, no, don't call me that. I don't want to be called that. And one of the fellas said, no, it's okay. It means the special nurse. It's not just, you know, because I wanted to be thought of as just one of them, but...
Did they call you Paksiji?
No,
that's,
I don't...
That's a good word for nurse.
Mm, yeah, there they use the word Nayangwa.
Yeah.
But there are, you know, of course, the dialect. And
sure.
The Arviat people coming from Anadai Lake were a group... Or some of the people at Arviat coming from Anadai Lake had a different dialect, too, I believe.
I should say. I crashed in an airplane in the interior, and so I came to know those people quite well.
Wow.
The inland people.
Yeah. I've got to write down the name of your book. I got to get this book.
I think you'll like it. You'll read about Arviat and some of the people who live there.
Yeah. Well, it's been great talking to you.
Good luck.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for calling this afternoon. And let me tell our listener, our caller there, that the name of the book is Zigzag. That's really easy to remember. Our guest, James Houston, is the author of Confessions of an Igloo Dweller. Is that book back in print?
Oh, yes, indeed it is.
Great.
I think it's around in paperback now, and what's called a trade paperback, a good-sized one. It was printed by Houghton Mifflin here and by McLellan Stewart in Canada.
Okay.
And quite a few other countries around the world.
Yeah. At one point, I tried to look for it, and it was, at least for a little while, unavailable.
Well, it never should have been. That really makes me fed up.
Yeah.
I mean, I could have had it every day since it was published. I find I have a good bookstore out here a block or so away from me, the Bookmart, and there are two girls there, and I go in and I can ask them for any book in the world. I mean, a book from Australia, Africa, Britain, France, and they have it for me right away. They do it on their computer. They ring it up and see if it exists, and if it does, who's the publisher and where is it from, and they'll get it in here in a couple of days.
Yeah. Well, I think our listeners should definitely look for both of these books, Confessions of an Igloo Dweller and Zigzag, A Life on the Moon.
I enjoy them as they do.
Talk with us about your sense of time and how that changed when you were living in the North, and then how that caused you some difficulty in Manhattan.
It certainly did. I mean, Inuit had an absolutely different sense of time than we have, or they wanted to look at the question of time in a different way. They thought nothing of going out on perhaps a walrus hunter, a seal hunter, caribou, something. And they wouldn't mind staying out 40, 50, 60 hours straight. They didn't build an igloo at the time. They might turn a sled up on its side if we had skins and perhaps lay down on the off wind side, but not to really sleep, just to sort of get out of the wind. But we would stay at open water, which is the coldest thing you can do, but the very best place for hunting to feed the families and so on. We would stay there for maybe 40 hours. I would become just half frozen and fed up. I could hardly take it. And they wouldn't seem to mind that at all. And when we were about to return home, which might be 10 miles away by dog sleds, they'd say, well, don't you think we should cut up the meat here? And I'd say, oh, goodness, no, I hope you... Yes, well, it is the best idea, so we're going to cut it up here, and then we'll go home. And so they would take all that time. Well, once we got back to a collection of winter tents or snow houses or whatever wherever we were, we would go inside and they would sleep for maybe 15 hours or something, except for having to jump up once or twice. They'd sleep steadily and so would I. So they used time. The weather commanded their time and these animals and the movement of everything did their time. Now, when I went to New York, I was still on that kind of time. If you count it in a straight line between 1948 and 1962, that's 14 years. And I'd been away from such things for that length of time. Finally, I'd be asked to go to a small board meeting or something there, and I'd be late. And so they said, well, get an alarm clock, on your wrist. I said, I didn't think anything like that existed. They said, it exists, all right. And if you don't get a hang of the time around here, you're finished. So I did get a hang of the new sense of time and the importance of being absolutely on time.
Speaking of time, we're out of time.
Uh-huh.
I'm sorry to say.
I am, too. It's
been a pleasure once again talking with you. Thank you so much.
Good. You're more
Take
than
care.
Welcome.
Take care.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
There. All the best.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
James Houston has been our guest. His latest book is Zigzag, A Life on the Move. He is also the author of Confessions of an Igloo Dweller. And if you're interested in his designs that he did as a designer, a master designer for Steuben Glass, look for the book Fire into Ice, Adventures in Glassmaking.